The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay, so the first thing I want to go over is this concept of sexual selection as opposed to natural selection. I want you to be able to contrast them. Give examples. You should know by now what we mean by natural selection. Well, then how can evolution happen also by something a little bit different, sexual selection? What does that mean? Somebody want to try to define it? Page 168. It's in the box. It wasn't in the regular text, but although he's really talking about things related to sexual selection throughout the chapter. Yeah.
Natural selection is something that allows the species or organisms to survive better. Like you get the trait that gives them a better.
Yeah, probably survival of the fittest isn't the best summary anymore of Darwinian evolution. It's really survival of the genes.
Yeah.
And, the body is just a means to pass the genes on.
And then sexual selection is where the male with the better sexual traits that make them more
The traits that affect mating will be selected for if they result in passing on the genes better.
So.
Right. It will have a correspondence to how well he passes the genes on. If the females are choosing males with long tails, okay, males will evolve with longer tails or they won't be able to pass their genes on as well. So it's really just an addition to natural selection, and Darwin discussed it in that way.
There may be some sexual traits that will make it more susceptible to being attacked by a predator.
Say that again.
Aren't there some sexual traits that will make it more vulnerable to attack from a predator?
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point. The sexual selection can result in traits that seem to reduce survivability. I mean, think of the peacock with the elaborate tail feathers. I mean, if they get too elaborate, the bird can hardly fly. It can't escape as well from predators. So, of course, that's a limiting factor. Sexual selection will still occur, but it can't occur in a runaway fashion, or it would lead to reduction in survival. The male won't make it to the point where he can mate. Okay, so the real obvious traits in evolving by natural selection are things like alarm calls that we talked about before, and of course many other things. Traits due to sexual selection per se, the male peacock feathers is one, and the swordtail fish is another, but there are again many, many traits like this. These are just very pronounced examples of these kinds of selection. So now,
Is it also true that traits that evolve by sexual selection can also be beneficial to natural selection, like they don't have to choose?
That's right, because in fact many times the female will choose males that are better foragers, for example. Well, that's obviously benefiting his survival and his ability to mate in the future as well. So yeah, they often coincide, but they don't have to.
What if the
Anthoxenectian
mate didn't mate, but now which mate was the next?
Very good question. Is everything about mate selection innate? Well, we can say right off that it can't possibly be if you look at things like, look at the jackdaws. Think of the male jackdaw trying to mate with Conrad Lawrence. Or the male jackdaw trying to mate with Conrad Lawrence. It wouldn't matter, because either one can, by early learning, a kind of imprinting that occurs in these birds, can learn the wrong thing if they're raised by humans and they're social animals. In many cases, we don't completely understand it. I don't think with humans, there have been many studies of innate selection in humans, and there's a lot of it is innate, but not by any means all. And probably the early learning aspects, how much males are influenced by the way their mothers are, what their mothers are like, it certainly influences them, but it's not a total determinant. I would like to see, and maybe there are studies like this, I would like to see if when males choose a mate that's like their mother, does the, as opposed to ones that choose a mate that are not like their mothers, does the pair bond last longer? I mean, there should be studies like that, and maybe there are such studies. Good topic for a paper. If you want to look it up, maybe you'll find something in that area. Because there are many studies of this. But let's talk about reproductive investment, because it makes a big difference in a number of aspects of mating behavior and differences in behavior between the sexes, of course. I just took some extremes here so you understand the concept. You should be able to add more to it. We saw the film of the stickleback early in the term. We saw that it's the male that does the nesting, care of the eggs. He is investing more. It's true, the female invested a lot in producing the eggs and all that, but after that, she's not taking time, you know, anymore. Well, that means the male investment in this case is larger. But in many other species, the male just fertilizes the eggs and disappears. And, of course, non-fish species, you will find the same thing. There's tremendous variation in investment. The text describes the lioness and the tremendous difference in investment there. The female invests more than 2 years. She can't have other offspring raising a cub. At least the 2 years if you include gestation, and then almost 2 years of pup care. Whereas the male can go off and mate with others, doesn't have to, of course, usually they're within a pride. But he also could be a loner male. He doesn't have to invest much at all. If it's in a pride, the male will function to defend the pride and so forth. So that could be considered an indirect investment. Okay. We saw in other species where the whole group is investing in the offspring. Remember the little meerkats? The spotted sandpipers are more complicated, where the male ends up doing the brood tending. It's not that the female can't, but she lays a clutch of 4 eggs and then often deserts the male, finds another male, and then lays another clutch of 4 eggs. But the male, if he wants his offspring to survive, has to stay with those first eggs. You know, if he didn't, then the eggs wouldn't survive, wouldn't hatch, and neither of them would have offspring. But the female, meanwhile, is off investing in another clutch of eggs. But the male generally will stay, and because that's his chance of passing on his genes. What are some other examples of reproductive investment? Think of primates. Yes. It doesn't have to be primates.
I was asking about the steering hamster in the paper. It seems that the male wants to get involved, but it doesn't have couldn't get involved. The female is so dominant.
Yes, that's right. The Syrian hamster, the little paper I wrote. Yeah, that's right. In fact, most people that use hamsters in the lab don't even know that the male plays a role, because they put them in situations where the male people will eat the young and so forth. But because I've kept them in more natural situations where they can live underground and so forth, when I first did that and I let the female go on a foraging trip, because I know she does that in the wild, and she covered everything I described there, but then I actually took her out and left the male, and I had a male living there. It was a large enough cage that she didn't beat him up all the time. You know, he could get away from her, which I told you also was pretty essential. And I thought he was going to go, I thought he would follow the literature, but he didn't read the literature. He went and took care of those pups. When he first put one in his mouth, I thought, oh no, they're all going to be gone. Not at all. He was just retrieving them, putting them back in the nest, behaving just like the female, doing good things. So this varies a lot. There are many males, of course, that do disappear, and the female does all the brood tending. But I suspect in some of these animals, unless you look at their natural behavior and look at it carefully, you might not realize that both sexes do invest. So reproductive investment is different than reproductive output, okay? By output, we simply mean number of surviving offspring. You have to say surviving offspring, because just having a lot of offspring isn't enough. They have to survive how long? Sorry?
To have their own offspring.
To maturity is almost there, but they have to survive to have their own offspring. That's what counts. Why do we not die if we've had all our babies? Because in very social animals, the older creatures often are more experienced and so forth, and they can benefit the young, their grandchildren, great-grandchildren, a lot. Okay. You can see why that would evolve. A long life can evolve in that sense, in a Darwinian way. So when we first look at it, it seems like males and females can most easily maximize reproductive output in very different ways. The male, because he doesn't have to bear the young and has the capability of fertilizing many females, the easiest way for him to maximize output would seem to be some kind of polygyny. Okay. Or polygamy, we ought to say. Okay? But for the female with limited egg production, she has a different, there's a difference in what her output will be, so it's better for her to try to maximize the quality of offspring. And that includes the way she chooses a mate. If the female is doing the mate choice. Okay, which often is the case. But anyway, these differences between the two sexes mean that the different mating systems are really compromises between the interests of the male and the female. Okay. They both want to maximize reproductive output, but they will tend to do it, or can do it, in very different ways. Okay. So this idea now of mate choice by females. The text describes two different properties of males. Initially, we think of she making a choice just based on how good he looks, how big he is, or whatever. But in fact, she's often judging other things as well. Various material benefits or resource provisions, And there's some good examples there. I'm asking for examples. Resource provision, for example, talks about the common tern that presents his mate with freshly caught fish. She will tend to mate more often with males that give her more. Very simple. Example of resource provision. What other material benefits besides giving the female things are there? We've talked about some of them. We've talked about birds, for example. Birds are
building nests.
Yeah, it could be the male that makes the best nest. Male that has a bigger territory or a territory that's richer in a richer area for foraging. There's different kinds of territory here. I don't think that territory is used in only one simple way. There are territories for just nesting and mating, and there are territories for foraging, and these can be very different. The way just attractiveness functions is interesting. There's a good discussion of it there in the book. You remember his discussion of the attractiveness of birds, where these birds with very bright plumage, the females almost always will choose the most elaborately colored, bright colored male. Why does she do that? You say she has a sensory bias to do that. But why did she evolve that sensory bias? It probably has it's probably related to one of the first two. You know, it probably indicates something, better health of the male. And they know that the carotenoids in their diet will affect their plumage, and that the carotenoids also benefit the immune system. The text cites one study where the males with higher carotenoid levels have indicating better diet, had less parasites if they were prone to parasites. And these dietary differences also explain that they need to develop the plumage that attracts a female, also explains some of the odd feeding behavior of some animals like the vultures that feed on feces, because the feces of some animals are very high in a certain substance, like a certain amino acid or something that the animal needs. That's a whole topic in itself, what animals eat, why they eat it. We talked a little bit about that before. I'll mention one other thing. First of all, if we're dealing just with mammals, the first food they get, of course, is mother's milk. That's their food and that's their drink. That's everything. So if you look at the nutritional components in mother's milk, you'll find out what the babies most need. What do we feed our babies? A lot of times we're feeding them cow's milk. What are they missing if they feed on cow's milk instead of mother's milk? Yeah?
Things that make them immune. Like immunities from the mother?
That's one thing. Yep. So are they getting higher protein? No. In fact, human milk is lower in protein. Primate milk in general is lower in protein than the ungulate milk. Doesn't mean the protein is bad for them if they're getting milk, but apparently the energy they get, higher carbohydrate content, is more important. or it wouldn't have evolved that way. The first solid food, of course, has to be something that they can masticate. I was quite amazed to learn that the first solid food of baby hamsters, and I observed this before I read about it, is the feces of the mother. And it turns out that during that period, her feces are not the same. They're less digested. The German term is vitamin shit. Literally, it's a vitamin enriched. And that's what they eat. It's a period, obviously adaptive for these little animals. But anyway, getting off the point here, led to by this attractiveness thing, because the attractiveness of the male will vary with his nutritional status. Okay. Now we talked about here resource provision. Often there, males of spiders will present a worm, a bug, the bigger the better. Some of them will try to get away with small gifts sometimes, and it doesn't work as well if the female has choice. Okay. So I'm bringing up this extreme situation where the male gives himself as the gift and she eats him. How could that have evolved? Did anybody figure that out? The Australian redback spider is the example used in the text, and he gives two reasons why this might be a good idea from the standpoint of passing on genes.
I remember one of the reasons he said that if he feeds himself to the female spider, the female spider will be at hungry and
she won't be as hungry if she's just eating, and the female spider that's not hungry won't be as likely to mate. That's right.
So, and the other one, the male spider, unlikely to be able to get to find another mate.
That's right. They have a short life, and the effort it takes to find another female and mate makes it fairly unlikely that he will be able to mate again anyway in his short life. So what the hell? You gonna pass on my genes? Go all the way. There are other animals, just a few, all insects as far as I know, that do this. Okay. When is a male more likely to do the choosing in certain species? This was discovered by, it was understudied because initially it was studied in birds. The brightly colored birds are almost always the male, but they do find some species where the females have brightly colored ornamentation also, indicating that seemed to have evolved by sexual selection, indicating that the male must be doing the choosing. And it often happens when there's a sexual reversal, meaning the usual sex role of the female taking care of the young and so forth, in cases where the male does have it, but the text describes in the box there an exception to that, where without sexual reversal, you still sometimes have male choice. And one thing that influences is just the relative number of animals. Did anybody find another reason there? I didn't have time to search through the whole chapter for this. And it seems to me there was another factor, but I didn't. Just think a minute. What other thing would make it more likely that the male would do the choosing? Yeah.
What is a very strong hierarchy? In your book, it seems the dominant jackdaw chose a female jackdaw to mate, right?
But in the case of if it's a group of animals and one of the animals is dominating all the other males, he may simply be chosen.
So he
by the females because he's so dominant, because he's the strongest, and so forth. You know, so that doesn't really mean he's choosing mates in the same way. But in fact, when you have animals with harems, you know, they do go around and gather them up, but they do so rather indiscriminately. They want them all, you know. Which is, it's hard to call that mate choice in the same sense we're using here. But when there are many more females than males, which isn't often the case, but in species where that occurs, okay, then the male is more likely to be the choosy one. So it's what we see in birds then certainly doesn't always occur. There are many different ways. What are we doing on time? Okay, I want you to think about the mating strategies of males. I didn't write down the answer here. I want you to think about what you know about animals. Why would males sometimes adopt very different mating strategies? Can you think of any? Because we've read quite a few examples of animal behavior now in the book. When we read sociobiology, there will be many more. Lawrence had many examples also. Why would different males adopt very different strategies? Well, for one thing, if it's in a group that you talked about with one really dominant male, what does that mean? They don't get a chance. And so he may beat up any male that tries to mate with a female, and that happens in primates, for example. So the male can't adopt the same strategy. He's got to form other strategies. He might be an animal that doesn't live with the group. So he will literally lie in wait for females to get away from the group a little bit. Then he'll find his chance. He will mate. And if he's within the group, he might have to, if he tries to catch a female when she's not under the eye of the male, he's taking a big chance. So he doesn't want to mate for very long. So he's got to be able to do it quickly and leave. There are some species where the males literally will ejaculate but store the ejaculate, and then very quickly can deposit the female and run. You see? But somewhere, I think it was in this book, there was an example of that. So they're very different strategies depending on social position primarily. Okay, in the social animals. Yeah.
I have another example of that move where there's more like a dominant male who like goes around and has a harem of like females. But then there's others who like kind of like just always there with females and just kind of like groom them and like become like friends with them and stuff like that, or like watch over their show, their young and stuff like that, so that they can like just kind of like kissing up to the point where the female lets him.
That's right. You find these kinds of examples in baboons, and you find these kinds of examples in human societies where one male would be very dominant. Kings in ancient India were said to have hundreds of children in their harems. But so the caretakers of the harem were often eunuchs, castrated males. So they couldn't have offspring by those females. But there are exceptions to that, and we're often, if we think all of those offspring were all by the king, we're probably wrong, because the females are going to have something to say about it too. And some of them will find other ways. Okay. The mating systems. I want you to name them and define them. You should know what they are. I thought the text had a nice presentation of that. He has a box where he describes monogamy, different kinds of polygyny, resource base and female defense polygyny, the lek-based polygyny, polyandry with female has multiple mates, and polygynandry, you have a combination of these. They're all very different systems. And what's so interesting, and the relative benefits to the male and to the female of these different strategies was made the clearest in Nick Davies' studies of the dunnock, this little European songbird, the hedge sparrow, because we should say, like humans, they have all the different mating systems can be found. And sometimes they switch one to the other. So, and he, by studying these birds over a long period of time, he was able to collect the data about whose offspring were whom. Now, I think he did genetic studies too. I'm forgetting that at the moment. So he can tell you what the average reproductive success of the male and of the female is if they're monogamous. So if you take monogamy as five as a number representing amount of success for the male and for the female, and you should look at that figure. It's figure 8.3. I didn't have a chance to, my scanner was being moved, I didn't have a chance to scan it and bring it to class. So if you have your textbook, it's on page 180. It's a good idea for you to bring the textbook because I can't always get all these things scanned in. Actually, I don't have to scan. I've got a disk, but I didn't have the attachment here, so I didn't have time to use my other computer. But anyway, it's a very nice figure. And what he shows there is that for the dominant male, anyway, he can do better than five. Polyandry will benefit the female, but not the male. The male's reproductive success, if he's the dominant male, will go down to 3.7. If he's a secondary male, go down to 3.0. The female's would go up to 6.7 if she can succeed in having more than one mate. Polygyny, or polygamy, benefits the male much more than the female, as you might expect. Goes from 5 to 7.6 if they have more than one mate. But for the female, it goes down to 3.8. So she prefers, if that's her two choices, she prefers the monogamous situation. In the case of polyandry, it's the female that's better benefiting. So the male then will choose monogamy if faced with those two choices. And either of those then could change into the polygynandry situation where the benefits, if they're already either polygynous or polyandrous, then the advantage would go down for the male, but up for the, up, down for the male, down slightly for the female. In the case of polyandry, it goes down for the female, polygynandry, that is, and it will go up again for the dominant male to the same level as the monogamous situation. But look at that and understand how he's getting that data. And the way he expresses the mating game is this way. I just copied this out of the book there. We should view the mating game not as a cooperation between the sexes, but as a conflict resulting in a compromise in the interests of one or both of them, which is what we were implying before in the class. what situation would make monogamy more likely? You remember the description of the Siberian hamster, the Jungarian hamster, we call it. But we call it the Siberian hamster usually around here when they're sold in pet stores and so forth. Okay. Podopus is the genus. When I've had them in the lab, we just called them Podopus. Siberian, very tiny little hamster. What makes an animal a hamster? You know what hamster means? It was right at the beginning of that little paper I wrote on hamsters. It means to hoard. Hamster is the hoarder. Okay, other animals hoard too, but the mammals have the cheek pouches. Most of them are called hamsters. So what is it that makes monogamy so likely for the Jungarian hamster? It's the environment, the extremes of the environment. Think of where they're breeding. It's extremely cold. It's difficult for them to... Did I get that page right? No, I'm sorry. This was supposed to be 181. He actually has data there. On the Siberian hamster litters, where both parents are attending versus a single parent. And you see the much better survival. There's always some pups that die. These are very large litters. Okay. So a few of them will die if both of them are attending, but most of them will die if there's only one parent because of the cold. She's got to forage a lot. She's got to keep herself and her litter warm. If she has to leave to forage all the time, she won't be able to warm the litter as much. They don't survive as well. So obviously, the animals will benefit. On the other hand, a few of them will survive, particularly if it's a very strong female. So the male still might benefit if he goes off another one. But in most cases, they don't. And I don't know what she does to try to maintain, keep him there. Yes?
Species in extreme cold weather are monogamous, like hamsters or penguins, or I think wolves that live in snowy mountains are also monogamous. But all species that live in hot deserts, are they equally monogamous? Because in extreme weather,
the factor that we're talking about is an environmental extreme. That's right. So it could. But you'd have to look at a lot of examples. Where would you find that kind of information? Some mammalogy books have that. Some ethology books will have a lot of species described, but they're more interested usually in the principles. But you're right, to establish that principle, you really have to have many examples. And you have to look for counterexamples. Just finding a few examples isn't enough to prove the point. He took a pretty extreme example there because so few of them survive if there's not two of them rearing the baby. You'd like to look among humans to find out if there's more wealth, the female doesn't have much problems being a single mother, or taking if she's in a more extreme situation where she would have a lot of difficulty, then is monogamy more likely to be durable? That would be a way to look at that among one in one species like human. Okay,
How are we doing in time? I still have a few minutes.
If a male mates with a female, but can't be absolutely sure that her offspring will be his, it benefits him to do things to prevent her from mating with another male. In ethology or sociobiology, we call that extra pair copulations. Okay. EPCs. So we don't get involved in any human morality and so forth. Okay. We're just talking about benefits, reproductive benefits in evolution. So obviously one thing the male can do is guard the female. That means he has to reduce his foraging and so forth. He has to stay around. You know, the males show up, what does he do? He attacks them, drives them off. So what other methods does the male have of preventing fertilization by another male? Can you think of other things he can do? In insects, you see it, or crabs. I like the crabs because they have an ejaculate that literally plugs up the female. It's like he puts his in and glues it in there. So now she can't accept sperm. And some of those animals that do that, the plug will form enough internally that other males won't realize that she has that. And so they'll mate, and yet the sperm had no chance of fertilizing any of her eggs. The male dunnock does something a little bit different. I mean, he might attack other males, but if he sees her around other males, then he knows, well, maybe it's too late. You know, I've been off foraging, and here I come back, and there's another male around. You know? So what does he do? He copulates with her more often. And the more he sees other males, the more he will copulate with her because of this phenomenon of last sperm precedence. Often, the vaginal area can store a lot of sperm. And usually the way it works is that the last to come in is the first to come out to be able to fertilize eggs. Okay? That's last sperm precedence. So he doesn't drive her away and say, you bad bird. He copulates with her more. Okay? And in many species, you'll find what the male is doing is just copulating very frequently. Look at the lion. Often they, or other large cats. I mean, the female is totally dominated quite a long time by one male. They mate and repeat it again and again and again. Now, whether that's really necessary to achieve fertilization, I really doubt. I think it has other functions. And then there are many invertebrates that the male may be mating with a female that has already mated. So he's evolved means to remove the sperm of the previous male. Yeah.
I know some species of fish, like guppies, can hold sperm and store it and have like three litters or groups of fry or whatever the right term is from one mate. Do you know anything about for that?
There have been examples where genetic analysis shows some pretty surprising things. We'll come up with an example here. But they also sometimes find mixed fatherhood. That does occur in animals where they have large litters. More often, it's only one, okay? And it is not always the last one. Because we're making it sound here like the male has the choice here. But in fact, the female can affect which sperm are fertilizing as well. But considering what the male can do here, take these insects where the male organ has evolved, so it's literally like a little bottle brush, and he can clean out the female before he deposits his sperm. I once was at the Museum of Comparative Zoology finding material on hamsters, and I came across a paper on the evolution of the male, the penile organ. And it is amazing, the variety and the functions of these things. Things that we never would occur to us, unless you're studying in a course like this. You know, the variety that you get. And it all has evolved with a purpose. In some cases, this last one here. The more general term is sperm competition, but that also has more specific meanings for many people. But in general, you're talking about a female that gets sperm from more than one male. Why does one male sperm win? Another male sperm does not fertilize the eggs, or in many cases, the egg. There's only one. Okay, one is just the quantity. It may just be a statistical matter. That's a very good reason to copulate many, many times. Overwhelm the opposition. Okay. So what else can occur? It's 5:00. We'll have to do that last point next time.